It was tragic, really. He exploded on stage.
It just went up.
It just was like a flash of green light, and that was it. Nothing was left. There was a little green globule on his drum seat.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.
Several, you know, dozens of people spontaneously combust each year. It's just not really widely reported.
Right. Yeah.
Well, let's talk about the wick effect, because that sounds like it's the big, you know, ballywick, no pun intended, of the skeptics. So it sounds to me like you've done a pretty good job of deconstructing this, but I also have a feeling that, you know, if you were to go to a skeptic and ask them, they would just quickly dismiss you with the wick effect and send you on your way. So let's settle that issue as best we can here right now.
Wonderful. Yeah. We've been blown off many times with the wick effect. And as we said earlier, we read about the wick effect. In fact, this was posited by some of the physicians back in the 1700s and 1800s. These people were all burning up very slowly in their own body fat over many, many hours, having been ignited externally by a drop cigarette or a drop pipe or an ember from the fireplace or whatever. We did the experiments ourselves because if the wick effect would work, end of mystery, perhaps. At least you can look at more specific examples where the wick effect perhaps could be dismissed if it was applicable to most of these cases. We find it not to be so. The BBC initially, when they did their programs before we got involved with them, they had a scientist, a Drysdale, if memory serves, McDougall Drysdale, did an experiment for the BBC in which he took a sliver of fat, wrapped it in cheesecloth, held it over an open flame from a Bunsen burner, and charred it. This was his proof that the wick effect could explain away a whole human body incineration to powder. And we're thinking, where's the bone in this piece of fat? You know, really bad experiment. But he's a scientist. We actually wrote to him. Said, you know, why didn't you do a more credible experiment? He's, you know, and his response was basically, you know, like, I lacked funding. Well, oh my God, you know, how much money does it take to get a ham shank from your butcher?
Yeah, get a piece of ham with a bone in it. Yeah.
We do that. We have funded all our research out of our back pocket. This is all personal money that has gone into this over the decades. We did not need a research grant to do this. Anyway, as our work became better known within the television community, obviously, it seems, and perhaps as a sad commentary on the nature of television production, but with rare exceptions, producers seem to think that they need to have a balanced program. So if they got Larry on a promoting SHC, they've got to have a fistful of debunkers saying, you know, SHC can't happen. So how does the latter group make its case? Well, they usually bring up the wick effect. And over the years, they've gotten slightly better and more honest at doing it. However, have their results been any more successful? We would argue they have not. John DeHaan is a world-renowned criminalist, expert in fire phenomena. He did a pig experiment for the BBC in 1979, the same show that we did our marinated ham shank experiment for. He took a pig, and the last thing we said to the producer for the BBC as he left filming from our office here in Harrisburg to go out to the West Coast to film John DeHaan doing the pig experiment was this. We said, if he gets the result that he tells you he can get, it will be a scientific achievement and it will be historically important. But please don't allow him to use an accelerant because in our cases that we've given to you, there was no accelerant present.
Yeah.
Dr. Bentley and Mrs. Reeser and Mrs. Conway, and we'd love to get back to the Conway case later.
Absolutely.
These people burned up in a fire that was absent of gasoline or kerosene or any kind of identifiable accelerant. So what do we see when the BBC runs its program? We see John DeHaan pouring a liter of gasoline on the pig. Whoa, stop the experiment right there. You know, we're not doing an honest experiment. That aside, after many hours, he's still left with a pig that is certainly recognizable as a pig carcass, even though it's pretty well burned up. But he used an accelerant to do it, okay?
Yeah. He
we talked to John about this. He told us he took a lot of heat from his colleagues in the fire service field for using gasoline. So the next time that he got to do his naysaying, to represent a human body this time rather than choose a pig, which was a fair representation, we will admit. We've said this ourselves many times. But rather than use a pig for the second anti-SHC burn experiment, he took a fistful of wax candles, wrapped them in cotton, laid them on a futon, and then lit them with a charcoal lighter. Okay, our first question to every firefighter that we have taught We teach annually an arson course here at the local community college in Harrisburg. I said, when was the last time your body would be described as containing 100% paraffin wax? And they all laugh. Never, of course. Why would a mainstream fire science expert, a criminalist, choose to represent a human body in a fire experiment with a fistful of wax? It makes no sense. Nonetheless, this is what Mr. DeHaan chose to do. Okay, fine. We'll let him light his fistful of candles, because otherwise, likely, that fistful of candles wrapped in cotton is going to sit on that futon until eternity and not spontaneously combust.
Yeah.
So he lit the candles. We'll give him that. If you watch the program, John says, you know, look, we've got a localized fire here. We have little radiant heat to burn anything that is adjacent to the futon. And the next scene you have is John in the burn chamber, standing there with a slightly charred area in the center of the futon. Surrounding objects are pretty much intact. He's claiming that we had a localized fire. It went out. It's just like these fire scenes that Larry Arnold purports to be SHC, but I've proven that you can replicate that fire scene under these conditions and, you know, end of SHC mystery. Do you know what? It's a complete fabricated lie. How can we say that and not be sued? Because we got from the producer of the program the original copy of the production that was sent to the network for broadcast.
Yeah.
And what the producer sent to us is just slightly different than the program that aired on national television. How does it differ? It differs in this one crucial way. Where John is standing in the burn chamber pointing out how localized the fire suddenly becomes not localized. It's a raging inferno. Then a few nanoseconds are going to full room flashover. Fire suppression equipment is called in by Mr. DeHaan, and the fire is extinguished. The viewing public never sees that footage. And yet Mr. DeHaan pops up at the end of the fire extinguishment to say, localized fire.
Why? I don't understand why the need. I'm hesitant to use the term, but I'm going to say it. I don't understand the need for the cover-up. I don't understand the need to cover up spontaneous human combustion, unless they just don't want people, you know, to be terrified by yet another thing that could kill them in this world. But why else? I just don't understand that. Do you get where I'm going with that, Larry? I don't know.
We get exactly mind-boggling. Where you're going with it. We get exactly where you're going with it, and it frustrates the hell out of us. The cover-up doesn't end there, and it's a good noun to choose for this. The next anti-SHC experiment that was done for national television in order of chronology was a show that we did a couple years ago for National Geographic in their Is It Real series.
Mm-hmm.
They devoted an entire show to spontaneous human combustion, bless their hearts. And we told them that we had just learned about a possible case in Belgium of a survivor case. And if they were willing to fly us over to investigate, we'd give them everything that we knew about SHC and we could see where the show went. They were eager to do that. They flew us over to Belgium. We had a great trip at their expense. Met the lady who was a victim of, we will frankly tell you right off the top, she was a victim of spontaneous combustion. We do not believe she was a victim of spontaneous human combustion, however, and there's no need probably to go into the case beyond that. But with the Nat Geo show, Is It Real? Of course, they have the required debunker, in this case, Mark Benecki, another criminalist, high regarded in the international community. He was with us during the investigation, and part of his explanation as to how these people burn up so completely is the wick effect. So once again, he attempts to prove the wick effect with a big, I'm sorry, let us stand corrected. This was not Mark Benecki who did this. They featured once again John DeHaan for the pig experiment itself, although Benecki was involved in the program.
Mm-hmm.
But they went back to the pig experiment again, once again with John DeHaan. This time John DeHaan wraps his pig sample in a blanket, does not use an accelerant this time, lights it. And as the cameraman told us, they ended up having another raging inferno in the burn chamber so quick. Did the fire engulf the area that the cameraman had to grab his camera you know, and flee the room. He was afraid he was going to lose his very expensive camera gear there. Fire suppression equipment was once again rushed in. The fire was put out. You know, this was put on camera. John admits, well, the experiment didn't quite go as I planned, but nonetheless, if it had gone as planned, I would have disproven SHC. And believe it or not, at the end of the program, Nat Geo says, the Wick effect works. I'm going, no, it didn't. you showed, this time you were honest enough to show the evidence that the Wick effect doesn't work. Why do you guys keep doing this? Why do you keep doing it? We have pondered that question that you were kind enough to ask, and we come up with either this is extreme xenophobia, the scientific community in general, and television production staff either doesn't want to scare the public or is scared themselves that this is something that is just so horrific and so befuddling that they don't want to represent the evidence truthfully. Or it's a case of academic reputation being on the line, and they've not been trained or taught that SHC or these kinds of fires occur, and therefore we're just going to, you know, say whatever we need to say. It's kind of like a politician, if you will, you know.
Yeah.
We'll say what we need to say to convince our audience that what we're saying is true, whether or not it is.
Strange. I just don't, yeah. And it just goes back to the terrifying aspect of this too, just because it's like a brain aneurysm, you know. You could hit you at any time, so you don't know.
Our experience with the show, and frankly, no one would know this if we didn't talk about it. But we're willing to talk about it because the evidence is on our side. We're not going to be sued for slander, and if we are, we're going to win our case. But it makes us question about what we see in all the paranormal shows that the television runs, you know. Or any of these shows being completely honest with the evidence? Or are they filtering it to slant the story to the conclusion that they want the viewing audience to see? And frankly, when a program network as reputable as National Geographic concludes what they did about spontaneous human combustion based on the evidence that they themselves filmed, we have to wonder, you know, where does veracity lie in these programs?
What's the agenda here? It's strange. Now, you said you wanted to talk a little bit more about the Helen Conway case, so have at it. Sounds like this is one that might be one of your personal favorites. And I know the audience loves the stories, so we should definitely treat them with some more. So tell us about Helen Conway and her tragic story.
Yeah, the Conway case is another of our favorites, in part because we discovered it. We brought it to the public's attention after dogged research, and it has some really importantly crucial aspects to it.
Okay.
Here's the Conway case. We were given permission as a non-professional firefighter to attend an advanced arson training course at the Pennsylvania Fire Science Academy, Pennsylvania Fire Academy, during our research, early years of research. This was a special privilege that was given to us because some firefighters, fire instructors at the local community college knew of us, knew of our seriousness in trying to document fire phenomena in general, and gave us permission to access this course because some of the material presented in this course you really don't want the public to know about. We were given permission to sit in. Okay. Very fascinating experience. We learned a lot. At the end of the course, the fire instructor, Buzz Trebold, Pennsylvania firefighters would know that name immediately, highly regarded in our state as a very credible instructor. He said, just got some photographs of a fire case that some people would call spontaneous human combustion. It involves a woman sitting in a chair, yada, yada, yada. And we're thinking, yeah, that's the Reeser case, because Mary Reeser in 1951 in St. Pete, Florida, burned up in a chair, leaving behind 1 foot, a few pieces of calcined vertebrae, and the rest of her 175-pound body, plus the chair, had burned down to a pile of rubble that weighed about 8 pounds. We're going to see photographs of the Reeser case. Great. Photographs are passed around the classroom. They come to us. Bingo. This isn't the Reeser case. There were two legs propped up against the front of the chair. The rest of this person's body is pretty much ash and rubble, amorphous mass of burned material. We know this is not the Reeser case. This is a case, up to that point in our research, we had no idea about. You know, it didn't fit any of the descriptions in our database.
You must have been excited.
We were. Rushed up to Buzz Trebold afterwards and said, you know, did the classic journalism questions, who, what, when, where, how. He didn't know who. He didn't know what. He didn't know how. As to where, he said, somewhere in southeastern Pennsylvania, and he didn't know when. So Southeast Pennsylvania, for those not familiar with Pennsylvania geography, is basically Philadelphia. So we're talking an area with millions of people.
Yeah.
No name, no date, no place other than somewhere in the greater Philadelphia area, perhaps. How do we track this sucker down? Sometime after that, we had the opportunity to meet with Dr. Wilton Marion Krogman in his Lancaster office to interview him about his personal involvement in the Reeser case back in 1951, a case that he called impossible. Krogman was a world-renowned forensic anthropologist. His specialty was the effects of fire on the human body. He had done experiments, and he had never in his experimental career been able to replicate a fire scene like he found in St. Petersburg with Mary Reeser in 1951. He called it the Cinder Woman case. So completely consumed was she.
Mm-hmm.
Classic SHC. In talking to Dr. Krogman about Reeser and about his career, he worked with Elliot Ness and had a fascinating career. He said, you know, Arnold, I just got these photographs sent to me. You might be interested in them. And they were the same photographs that we had seen at the Fire Academy School.
Nice.
Okay. Now, was there a return address on the envelope? Yes, there was. We had our first contact. It wasn't too long after that until we were able to make contact with a gentleman named Robert Neslin, who happened to be the fire marshal for Upper Darby Township, which is in southeastern Pennsylvania, outside Philadelphia. And he was the one who took the photographs because he had been at the fire scene. We now had a place, a date, a name, and the name of the victim also, and that was Helen Conway. We made contact with Meslin. We subsequently made contact with Paul Haggerty. He was the fire chief at the time, and Harry Lott, who was the assistant fire marshal at the time for Upper Darby Township, three senior fire people involved in the case. Conway case is particularly intriguing because, A, it looks like classic SHC, two legs propped up against the front of a chair. The rest of Mrs. Conway's body is, as we said, kind of an amorphous mass. Set of 12 photographs, black and whites, perfectly in focus. Meslin was the fire photographer at the time. He took a brilliant set of photographs, shared them willingly with us as he shared his recollection of this amazing case because he was completely bumfuddled by it. He told us, as did his firefighting colleagues, that collectively they had never seen in their decades of fire service any fire scene that came close, remotely close, to emulating the case of Conway, nor had they ever found a case since responding to that fire call in November of 1964 that looked anything like the Conway case. In fact, Meslin told us as he would go to fire conventions and fire training academies after having dealt with the Conway case in 64, he'd ask his fellow firefighters, you know, had they encountered fire scenes like this? And they told him that they didn't believe he had encountered what he described to them because such fire scenes don't happen. He knew better. Anyway, the Conway fire scene is incredibly like classic SHC in that we have almost in complete incineration of the body itself with enough material left behind to show that the amorphous burned matter once had been a human body. Her left forearm is burned right to the bone, but you can see a charm bracelet hanging from the ulna against the arm of the chair. In fact, when the smoke was ejected, in this case there was intense black smoke filling the room in which Mrs. Conway burned up. But once again, there was no odor of noxious burning flesh. In fact, all the three chief fire responders told us there was no odor present at the burn scene.
Hmm.
There is minimal burn damage to the walls behind the chair. The chair sat in a corner. In fact, the heat pattern indicates that this was a very hot, short-lived fire. No fire damage overhead. What is so crucially important about the Conway case, though, is the time factor.
Yeah.
And here we get really important because, as the WIC proponents advocate, these are low-heat, long-term smoldering fires. The body has to have many, many hours to slowly render out and provide fuel for these fires that slowly consume the human body to ash. Even though we've never heard of this happening in a crematorium, we've never heard of it happening in a summer barbecue, we've never heard it happening at a particular fast food chain that advertises how it grills its burgers over an open flame. We've never heard reports of hamburgers or steaks burning to ash on an open flame grill.
Yeah.
Nevertheless, the time element of the Conway case comes down to this. all three senior fire responders told us Mrs. Conway had no more than 30 minutes from the time that she was known to be alive in the second floor of her home in Upper Darby Township on that Sunday morning in November of 1964 until the fire crew arrived to put out a fire that really didn't need to be put out. No more than 30 minutes. They stand by that. In fact, Meslin, in writing to us, says puts it at 21 minutes. Now, 21 minutes is damn fast for
yeah.
a fire that consumes a body to this extent. Even John Nahan admits to us that he can't explain it.
But yeah, yeah.
21 minutes is the upper limit because in sitting down with Bob Meslin, we worked out the timeline because timelines in SHC are very important.
Mm-hmm.
The 21 minutes represents the time, as we were told by the fire department, represents the time from when Mrs. Conway was known to be alive in the house until the fire department arrived, ejected the smoke, and Mr. Meslin could take camera in hand and start taking his photographs. In order for Mr. Meslin to take the photographs, he had to first get to the fire scene, leave the fire scene, go to his house, pick up his camera, return to the fire scene, during which the firemen are ejecting the smoke from the burned room,
yeah.
allowing then Mr. Meslin, the fire photographer, later the fire marshal, to begin taking those 12 dramatic fire photographs. When you factor in all those time elements from the 21-minute window, what you come down with is 6 minutes, 360 seconds from the time that Mrs. Conway was known to be alive until the fire department arrived initially at the fire scene to find a fire scene with a fire that did not need to be put out. 6 minutes. That's for a body to be burned to the extent that Mrs. Conway's body was burned. And the photographs clearly depict this. To have that done in 6 minutes just wipes out the Wick effect.
Yeah, it's mind-boggling. It defies explanation, even. It's you know, do we know of, I mean, is there a natural speed at which fire would consume like that? Or, you know, I'm just baffled here.
Yeah, and thank you. You should be baffled. If you understand anything about the effects of fire under normal conditions on the human body, you must be baffled. We've looked at a number of cases, some with photographic documentation of people who have been burned up in conventional fires. We have a case not too far from our office here in a neighboring community where a gentleman was working on his lawnmower in the basement of his home. Stupid dimwit was smoking, cigarette smoking. Open flame, guess what? The gasoline fumes ignited, burned up himself, and burned up the entire structure around him. The building burned basically to the ground, and yet the firefighters, after they put out the blaze, could go in, pick up the body intact, take it to the morgue where it could be photographed and autopsied. The body, though obviously severely burned, fourth-degree burn, remained intact and could be autopsied.
See, that's, yeah, that flies in the face of what we're talking about here, yeah.
Mrs. Reeser, Dr. Bentley, and hundreds of other examples that we could regale you with weren't intact. They were dry, calcined powder.
Strange. Now, I kind of consider this program especially part of, like, the historical record. Since this is our big showcase of SpawnCom, let's talk about the Mary Reeser case, because that sounds like that is, you know, the other big daddy of SHC, if you will.
Yeah, it is. Until our research became publicized, the Reeser case was the case to argue for or against classic spontaneous human combustion. Mrs. Reeser met her flaming... Oh, Mrs. Reeser is a Pennsylvania native, and for whatever reason, a lot of the classic cases are the best ones that we've been able to uncover often have a Pennsylvania connection. Maybe it's not by happenstance that we were born and bred here in Pennsylvania, but anyway, Mrs. Reeser spent most of her life here in Pennsylvania, in the Keystone State, but in the latter days of her life, she had briefly retired, relocated to St. Petersburg, Florida, was unhappy down there, and was planning actually to come back to Pennsylvania when she met her flaming demise. The story is this. On the evening of July 1st, 1951, she was visited by her son, Dr. Reeser, and by some friends, and she was left alone in her apartment at one end of a hallway on Cherry Street, seen last at 9 o'clock in a bathrobe in some satin slippers, had taken two Secanol sleeping tablets, and presumably was smoking a cigarette or it was thought she might be about to light a cigarette.
Mm-hmm.
Fast forward overnight to, oh, by the way, the following morning about 4:20 a.m., the landlady heard some commotion, awakened, but saw or determined nothing was amiss, went back to sleep. And the clock, it was determined later in Mary Reese's apartment, had stopped at 4:20 a.m.
Hmm.
Probably significant. But anyway, fast forward a few more hours to about, I think if memory serves, around 8 o'clock, Western Union Messenger arrives with a telegram from Mary Reeser. Basically, the telegram was to confirm to Mary Reeser that all arrangements had been made. She could relocate back to her beloved state of Pennsylvania. Messenger knocked on the door, got no response from Mary Reeser, went down to the other end of the hallway, roused Pansy Carpenter, the landlady, and said, got a telegram for Mrs. Reeser. Pansy said, I'll take it down to the hallway. She went down to the hallway, knocked on the door, no response, touched the doorknob. The doorknob to Reeser's apartment was warm to the touch. She screamed. Two painters walking at a home across the street heard the screams, rushed over, knocked down the door, and walked into a scene that completely horrified them. Mrs. Reeser was in one corner of her little apartment, found burned to ash, as was the chair in which she had last been seen seated. Fire damage was localized basically to the chair and to the body. Left behind, as we said earlier, was 1 foot, the satin slipper still on the foot, a few pieces of calcined vertebrae, and a skull that it was said at the time by the first responders to have shrunken to the size of a teacup, an orange, or a grapefruit. Two firefighters, one of whom we actually interviewed, Nelson Aders, actually showed up and shoveled up the ashes and took them to a morgue for autopsy. Dr. Krogman, whom we mentioned earlier, happened to be vacationing in St. Pete at the time. As we said, he was a world-renowned forensic anthropologist, skilled in the effects of fire upon the human body. And he took a personal as well as professional interest in the Reeser case. And he was confounded and befuddled and perplexed by the fire scene that Mrs. Reeser left behind. He called it impossible. He said that only in his experiments when he had exposed cadavers to 3,000 degrees for 12 uninterrupted hours in a retort could he achieve reduction of a human body to the extent that was found in Mary Reese's apartment. He said, you just don't get powder. He told us that face-to-face. He told us that in his published reports of the Reese case. You just don't get powder, except that you do in the Reese case, and you do in the Bentley case, and you do in the Conway case, and many others. He was perplexed by the absence of the characteristic noxious stench of burned flesh at the fire scene. And in this case, there was once again that redolent perfume-like aroma that pervaded the victim's room. Impossible, said Dr. Krogman. Well, there was a lot that was impossible in the Reeser case, and that was just one aspect of it. There just seemed to be nothing that couldn't be possible in the Reeser case that didn't make sense. We're going to quote Dr. Krogman here specifically. Quote, I have posed the problem to myself again and again, remarking about how to explain the Reeser fire scene. And I always end up rejecting it in theory, but facing it in apparent fact. He had to throw in the adjective apparent. You know, the fact couldn't stand alone. It had to be apparent.
Mm-hmm.
His conclusion, the Cinder Woman couldn't happen, but it did. End quote. So here's the mystery. This, as we said earlier, when we did our research initially down at the Library of Congress, we went to the local newspapers. They reported this as straight news. For 1 month, this was front page story in the local newspapers. You know, how did Mrs. Reeser burn this way? Did she fall asleep, having taken a sleeping tablet and dropped a cigarette on her lap? That's what the naysayers argue to this day. But there are lots of chair fires in this country. Some 4,500 people, unfortunately, every year die in fires in this country. Many of them are the result of smoking mishaps. But if everybody was burning up as completely as did Mary Reeser from smoking mishaps, we wouldn't be talking about a mystery. We'd be talking about a conventional fire scene, wouldn't we?
Mm-hmm.
We wouldn't be talking about fire scientists covering up the evidence and misrepresenting the evidence, as we've already suggested some of them are willing to do in order to not have to deal with spontaneous human combustion.
It's humbling in a sense, too, because when you really consider it, you know, fire with, you know, it probably predates the wheel as this humankind's great first invention, and we still don't really understand it, apparently, if we're still flummoxed by spontaneous human combustion.
Yep. As we said earlier, the debunkers really give us some of our best arguments for the reality of SpawnCon. First, they're, some of them are very quick to call the whole body of evidence as a hoax. We'll cite specifically Dr. Adelson, who was a coroner, a medical professional, who claimed that he did a study of spontaneous human combustion, but yet when he was handed photographs of the Conway case and Dr. Bentley and asked to explain how these fires could occur, he called the photographs hoaxes. Direct quote. And he was asked, well, how do you reach that assessment? What is your conclusion that these photographs are hoaxes? And keep in mind, this is before Photoshop days.
Yeah.
When if you're going to create one of these photos, you had to go to a great deal of expense and you had to have a great deal of skill to recreate these fire scenes, if they are indeed hoaxes. And his retort was, well, the human body simply doesn't burn this way, therefore these photographs have to be hoaxes because they can't depict real fire scenes. Well, that's clearly not true. We mentioned earlier Dr. Benecki in connection with the Nat Geo program. He has said to us and in writing about spontaneous human combustion that there are no cases on record in which internal organs are burned as completely or more completely than external body parts. Therefore, these fires can't originate within the body, and therefore spontaneous human combustion cannot occur. Well, look at the evidence from Mrs. Reeser. Look at the evidence that we have for Dr. Bentley. Look at the evidence that we have for many other cases that we document in great detail in our book Ablaze, and you will find no evidence whatsoever in any of the medical reports of these victims that mention a pancreas, a liver, a heart, the lungs. All those internal organs are ashened, and yet we have a lower leg left behind for George Mond in upstate New York. We have Dr. Bentley's lower leg. We have Mrs. Reese's foot. So we do have external body parts left. So Mark Benecki's explanation and position to debunk SHC is disproven.
Yeah, it's almost like I can't explain this, so it couldn't have happened.
Right. And our comeback to these people is you simply can't suppose away the facts. You obviously can do that, but then you're not being honest with the evidence. You're not being honest as a scientist. You're certainly not being honest in your methodology.
It's unfortunate. It's at the risk of sort of jumping to the end, because I have a lot more stuff I want to talk to you about, but do you think, given the climate of the experts, quote-unquote, you know, do you think that we're ever going to get to a point here where SHC is given its proper due as real, as a viable phenomenon?
We sincerely hope that that would have happened with the publication of Ablaze back in 1995. It did not, sadly. We've quipped that probably SHC will continue to be vehemently, ferociously, and viciously debunked by mainstream orthodoxy and science, until some very high-profile public person, such as a president or Hollywood actor or actress, goes up in a ball of blue flame in front of a bank of television cameras.
Yeah.
At which point, mainstream science will say, oh, we've known about this for centuries. We talked about this back in the 1700s, and there's, you know.
Yeah.
But then they're still going to have to explain it, aren't they? And they haven't been able to explain it yet, because under those circumstances, clearly the Wick effect will once again be blown away, and they're going to have to come up with something else. Well, maybe they'll come up with some of the theories that we develop and postulate and speculate about in Ablaze and say, well, maybe Larry Arnold got it right after all, and we just should have been paying attention to him all these years and whatever.
That's the hope, right?
Maybe we'll get our Nobel Prize in Medicine posthumously.
Don't talk like that, Larry. We'll get it before you're gone. Don't worry. Now, I've also seen here that beyond the strange smells, there's also one of the other recurring sort of themes or patterns, if you will, of the SHC cases is some kind of greasy film.
Sometimes, yeah. Yeah. If not, often not so much greasy film, but a baked-on caramel coloring. In the Mott case in upstate New York, which happened in the spring of 1986. This is the retired firefighter who was discovered by his son having burned through. Actually, the fire scene itself was discovered by his son, Kendall Mott, but the actual nature of the fire that consumed Kendall's father was not discovered by Kendall but by a neighbor, because Kendall never stepped far enough into the home of his father to actually see the nature of the fire damage that consumed his dad.
Mm-hmm.
But George Mott, a retired firefighter in Crown Point, New York, up near Ticonderoga, in late March of 1986, managed somehow to burn himself to powder, burn himself through his bedding, through the mattress, through the floor planks under the bed, and into an earthen crawl space underneath his 20 by 40 foot tinderbox of a home. Without burning much of anything else, with a few exceptions, this is a very complex and very confusing fire scene we devote, as we do to some of these classic cases, a full chapter in a blaze to the Mott case. Mm-hmm. It's far too complex to go over in detail and in this kind of an environment, in this kind of discussion.
Yeah.
Get the book if you want to know more.
Absolutely.
But we were at the fire scene shortly after it occurred. We can attest that there was absolutely no flame or heat damage to the ceiling directly above George Mott's bed. So there's no pillar of hot gas going up to the ceiling. Much as in the Conway case and in the Bentley case, it appears that these victims actually burned down. They didn't burn up, which is the vernacular. These people burned downward, physically, literally burned downward.
Weird.
Leaving behind a real mystery. The two key local first responders at the Mott fire scene have both told us their conclusion, professional conclusion, is based on best evidence and the exclusion of all other possibilities, George Mott died by spontaneous human combustion. And that is extraordinarily rare for fire professionals, emergency response people to reach that assessment and state publicly, but they have. And that would be Bob Purdy and Tony Moret. Did a bang-up job as first responders in the initial investigation. They invited us to come in with our background and expertise and help them. They were looking for answers, as were we. And we all have concluded and have gone on the record of saying, to the best of our abilities, based on best evidence and thorough investigation, Mr. Mott did not burn by the wick effect. He did not burn by an electrical arc from an outlet in his bedroom. He burned up or burned down by spontaneous human combustion.
Strange. Now, just to take us back to that caramel coloring, tell me a little bit more about that. What is this, like some kind of...
How we got sidetracked with that is that, having been at the Mott fire scene and documented it thoroughly throughout the Mott fire scene, in that 20 by 40 foot home, caramel coloring was baked on a lot of the horizontal surfaces, very little of the vertical surfaces, but on countertops, on silverware that was exposed to the open air, on desktops and so on, that caramel coloring was present in many of the places in his home. Probably due once again to carbon content vaporizing off the body as it is being consumed by whatever is the energy that is doing the quote-unquote burning. In many of these cases, we don't believe that we're dealing with an oxidizing type of fire to begin with. We're dealing with something that is biochemical or bioelectrical or plasma-like, perhaps even occurring at the quantum level within the body. But the fat, the carbon content of the body is released very quickly, and what is not consumed by the nature of the energy itself quickly spreads through the local environment and is baked on by the heat of that energy. And so we can it really looks like caramel coating is what it looks like. And you can scratch it with your fingernail in some cases.
Weird. See, this is such a strange thing. And then,
in fact, that's what tipped off Kendall Mott initially when he went to visit his father. He noticed that the interior of the house seemed incredibly dark. In fact, he first thought that his father had installed new window glass or new drapes that made the interior of the home so dark. And actually what made it dark was this caramel coating that had been baked on the window glass.
Ooh, that's just creepy. And in the article you sent me, I mean, we're already dealing with a very strange phenomenon here, but something stood out to me that really completely made me flip my lid. And
what was that?
I'm excited to tell you. In the article, you say, I'm going to quote you here, many of these blazes sight upon straight lines, sometimes hundreds of miles long, and provocatively hinting at a heretofore unsuspected cartography for combustion. What is this, Larry? What are you talking about? I'm stunned, and I want to know more.
Great. Well, delighted you want to learn more and are asking about this. This is one of our many discoveries as we've taken our research into spontaneous human combustion, wherever the facts tend to lead us to go. It occurred to us one moment that you mentioned the Bermuda Triangle earlier in this interview. We've been down to the Bermuda Triangle many times, did submarine archaeology down there on one leg. There is nothing, despite Ivan Sanderson's coining of that phrase, that indicates to us that the so-called Bermuda Triangle area of anomalies, and there are some strange things that occur in that area generally, but there's nothing that tells us that the anomalies occur in a specifically shaped triangular area.
Yeah.
But geographically, it's interesting because our database is fairly large, and you need a large database to do this. We believe that we're the first person who even had the sufficient data to attempt this project, was to look for patterns of these unusual anomalous fires. And looking for patterns involved, among other things, plotting the location of these cases on a map. And because we had more cases per capita of strange fires in the United Kingdom, we took out a big map of the United Kingdom and started plotting case after case of SHC and also spontaneous fires that occurred in buildings and other objects on a map to see if we could find a pattern. What we found was that many of the sites of anomalous fires could be connected if you laid a straight line over the map. Obviously, you can connect by straight line 2 points. Mm-hmm. Nothing mysterious there, basic high school geometry, even elementary geometry. Connecting 3 points by a straight line, it gets interesting, but statistically it's not real significant. The statistical significance comes when you can connect 4 points, 4 allegedly random points by a straight line.
Yeah.
Then we're starting to look for something that might have merit. What we found in our plotting of cases of anomalous fires in the United Kingdom is that more than 80% of the strange fires that we know about that have occurred in the United Kingdom that we knew about in 1975 could be connected by straight alignments. Some alignments connecting 6, 7, perhaps as many as a dozen cases of strange combustion events. That is significantly statistically important.
Absolutely. That is just, it just adds a whole other layer of bizarreness to this thing, Larry. I'm just, you're leaving me in a quandary tonight, and I love it.
One of the things a good theory should do is if you apply the theory, it should lead you to new discoveries that the theory posits, or in this case, the hypothesis posits.
Mm-hmm.
What we did in one of our trips, one of our research trips to the United Kingdom, was to go to areas that the fire lane map, as we call it, the cartography of combustion, suggested would be hotspots for perhaps cases that we had not known about.
Right.
It worked. We went up to the Lincolnshire area, which is has a triangle of fire in northeastern England. We sat down with the fire brigade commander for that jurisdiction, introduced ourselves, explained why we were there, and asked if he had in his fire career, in his fire files, any cases that might be described as classic SHC. His first response was, nope, don't know of any. Couldn't, because what you're asking about basically doesn't happen, although I've heard mention of it, rumors of it. And then he paused, he got really quiet and became very pensive, and we'll never forget this moment. It still sends chills through our body. He pushed himself away from his desk and got lost in thought for a minute or two, and then came back, sat upright, looked at us, and said, well, you know, a couple years ago. And what he described to us was a case that fits the classic SHC virus. Person living alone in a tinderbox of environment had been seen for several days. When the home was entered by first responders, they walked through the home looking for the person who lived there. They couldn't find him. This is a place that actually had tarp, oil-soaked paper with windows. So we're talking about a really combustible tinderbox here. What they eventually discovered in walking through the room, which was basically had little narrow aisles on either side of which were stacks of newspaper and other highly combustible materials, the firefighters had actually been walking through the ashes of the person who lived there.
Ooh.
He had burned to ash between piles of newspaper. And we looked at the fire brigade commander and said, you know, that sounds just like spontaneous human combustion to us based on our research. And he said, well, you know, I kind of have to agree with you. So we found that case by following the mapping of the fire lanes on this map of the United Kingdom. Several years later, in 1980, there was a case that happened in western UK, in Wales. It happened in a little teeny town that we had not even could find on our original map, we had to go to a gazetteer. We first looked on our fire lane, on our fire lanes, the two of them that we had plotted that shot two whales, and one of those fire lanes shot right through the little town where Henry Thomas, in January of 1980, experienced what could be described as classic spontaneous human combustion. So the hypothesis of the cartography of combustion has led us to new discoveries, i.e. new cases that we did not know about, but the theory said should lead us to those cases. So we think the theory is really incredibly interesting. We devote, in fact, two chapters in Ablaze to the alignment of these mysterious fires. And it raises some real perplexing issues for geologists, for geophysicists, for the insurance industry in particular.
Exactly, yeah. Well, it should eventually, hopefully, lead us to answers in a way, because at least we're, you know, that suggests some means of potential prediction or some methodology of you know, getting ahead of this in some way, too.
Exactly. It raises the question, why do these incredibly rare, bizarre, localized, spontaneous combustions occur in linear patterns over hundreds of miles? Could there be more fires that Larry Arnold and British researchers haven't yet discovered that could be located by following these fire trackways? We believe so. And then what is the nature of the energy that causes fires to occur in linear patterns in the United Kingdom?
What's your, like, most recent case here in the United States for potential spawn comb?
The most recent case we probably stake our reputation on in the United States was is Kay Fletcher back in 1995, 1996. We keep getting those 2 years mixed up in our consciousness. It's one of those two. Slightly more recent case from British Columbia, also a survivor case. This year we've had leads on two cases, neither of which we believe is spontaneous human combustion. We're talking to you in June, so if memory serves, this was back in April. There was a gentleman at a porn shop in San Francisco who rushed out of the porn shop ablaze, collapsed in the street. Our suspicion is there was probably a huffing incident, and he caught himself ablaze back in the viewing booth. But we don't know that with absolute certainty. We still have to follow up. We're waiting for the San Francisco department to wrap up their investigation so that we can get access to their conclusions and their evidence for the case. We don't think it's SHC, but there's enough curiosity about it that we're not willing to dismiss it outright without further investigation.
Yeah. Jumping back here to the trends that you discuss in this paper you sent me, you say this will be interesting to explore, because it sounds like obviously you wrote the paper here before 2004, because you say it appears to be cyclical, this being spontaneous human combustion, with peak occurrences about every 33 years and secondary cycles of 11 years, and you say that the next peak is projected for circa 2004, and then they say, jokingly, we'll have to wait and see, yes? So, did that bore itself out for you that it seems to have peaked again in 2004?
Right. The prediction for a spike in spawn comb events in 2004 was based on best evidence at the time that we had available. Mm-hmm. That spike, to our knowledge, did not occur, and had it occurred, we do believe we would have learned about enough cases to support that cycle for 2004. It did not happen. So either the analysis of the preceding centuries worth of data is slightly faulty, or something occurred to change the cyclical nature that should have happened in 2004, the nature of the energy or whatever factors caused the preceding 30-year cycle to occur over several centuries. Something changed and it did not happen in 2004. We don't know the answer to that other than to tell you that the anticipated spike in 2004 did not manifest to the best of our knowledge.
So have you abandoned the theory of the cyclical nature, or does that still hold water? Just like as you said, maybe something has happened to change the cycle.
We have not abandoned the mathematics that led us to that prediction. We've also found in looking for other kinds of patterns with astrophysics, for example, that we found a correlation. Many of the classic cases of spawn comb tend to concur with episodes of high solar activity, very strong geomagnetic solar activity tends to coincide with many cases of SHC. We've been recently having a lot of very active solar activity, which means a lot of very active disturbance in the Earth's magnetosphere. In fact, it's predicted that maybe after this interview ends here in a few minutes, we can go outside and see if the Aurora Borealis is visible over South Central Pennsylvania tonight because of very recent solar storms. If that connection is indeed valid, we would anticipate learning about a recent case of SHC because of that increased solar activity. Again, we're dealing with hypotheses at this point. Some of them may be completely fallacious, but we will not know until more evidence presents itself to us.
Absolutely. Well, it sounds like you've done an amazing job here of researching this. Is there much of a community for SpawnCom, or are you sort of like the lone voice in the wilderness here?
There have been a couple other researchers who have done credible research and publication, but it does appear, to the best of our knowledge, humbly, that we're the guy who's spearheaded it. And to our knowledge, again, we have the largest database. And we've certainly been prominent in trying to get the public to have a broader awareness of this real Fortean enigma. What we learned in our various college studies and taking fire science courses, both at the local college level here at the Pennsylvania Fire Academy and in talking with fire officials around the world, is that one should always be prepared for the unexpected, to be open-minded, to be able to defend your assessment of a fire scene in court, if need be, and also to enjoy as well as to respect the challenge. And all those things we have attempted to do in the 30-plus years that we've devoted to documenting these incredibly bizarre, mysterious blazes that history has called spontaneous human combustion.
Where can people get a hold of A Blaze, The Mysterious Fires of Spontaneous Human Combustion, your big book here?
There are two easy ways. First, of course, is Amazon. Just go to Amazon, type in A Blaze or Larry Arnold, and you'll come up with that, the way to order through Amazon, of course. The other way is to go to our website, Parascience, parascience.com, and drill down and email us an order or request for the book, and we'll ship it out to you or to anyone who orders it through the website. The list price is $24.95. It's 500 pages long. It is hardback. We have some first edition copies left. In fact, if you go to Amazon, there are some people that have been trying to sell first editions, actually first edition used copies, for $80 a crack. We can do better than that, and we'll autograph it for free if you'd like. We make a guarantee with our Blaze that we don't know any other author has ever made. The guarantee is this: you buy the book if you've not read it before, and after completing your reading of the book, if you can honestly tell us that you have not learned something new by reading A Blaze, we will refund the purchase price.
Wow.
We are so convinced that our research is both solid, archivally based, as well as grounded in our firsthand interviews with fire responders around the world, that there is no other source for this information than within the covers of A Blaze.
That's a bold proclamation, but just based on this conversation, I have a feeling that that guarantee's held up over the years, because, I mean, you're blowing my mind here over the course of these last 2 hours. So, now, I noticed in the article you sort of put forward the suggestion for, I guess you could say, a new moniker for SHC. Super hyperthermic carbonization. So is that just an attempt to move away from the bizarre, I guess you could say, or the tantalizing or the scandalous, if you will, version that is spontaneous human combustion?
Yeah. Spontaneous human combustion itself is a three-word phrase that really rankles the ire of mainstream fire professionals, as we've already explained this evening. And it has a connotation of the supernatural, of the eerie, of things that scientists don't like to deal with.
Right, loaded.
So we like the acronym SHC, so we came up with super hyperthermic carbonization, which is another very good descriptor for classic SpawnCom fire scenes. You know, we're dealing with obviously what everyone interprets as combustion. It involves a human being, and it appears to evoke very high temperature, super hyperthermic. So we keep the acronym SHC and make it sound less intimidating to some members of the professional fire services community. As you bring that up, we've also coined or proposed another aspect to the professional firefighting community. That is the degree of burn classification. When we grew up, there were 3 degrees of burns, first, second, third.
Mm-hmm.
Third degree being the most severe, first degree being reddening of the skin, second degree being blistering of the skin. As our research unfolded over the decades, fire science came up with a fourth degree burn classification. Third degree is now deep burning of the skin. Fourth degree is when the burn gets down into the bone. But what we're dealing with in terms of classic SHC fire scenes, Mary Reeser, Dr. Bentley, George Mott, etc., goes way beyond fourth degree burn classification. Way beyond. So we have coined the new classification for a fifth degree burn injury, which would encompass classic SHC fire scenes. And when we were last meeting with fire officials in Scotland Yard, New Scotland Yard, we sat down and went over the four classifications of burns and said, you know, the photographs that we were showing to you fall beyond fourth degree. Would you not agree? And the gentleman said, yep, you're right. You know, this is a whole new burn classification. And we said, since you guys are putting together a new textbook at this very moment, maybe you would wish to include in it a new classification, the fifth degree burn. So if that was done, we don't know that it was. He said it probably would be if he was going to pursue it. If you ever hear about a fifth degree burn classification, you can credit Larry Arnold for proposing that and getting it officially recognized, because these classic SHC fire scenes clearly warrant this new burn classification category.
Yeah, they stand alone as something truly, truly strange. I'm just so thrilled with this conversation. I've had such a good time. I just can't thank you enough here, Larry. Looking at the publication date for Ablaze, that was back in 1995. Obviously, you do a lot of speaking engagements, a lot of media appearances, and write a lot of articles. What's going on here for you in 2011 and beyond? Do you have any plans, you know, for a sequel to Ablaze or a follow-up or of some kind, or even, you know, some other avenue of exploration? Because I see here, and, you know, I'm already going to say we're going to have you back on the program again in the future, because I'll be honest, I haven't had a chance to sit down and read Ablaze all the way through, so I'm dying to really dig into that and have you back on to even get further into this mystery. But I see you've written about the parapsychological impact of the accident at Three Mile Island. Sounds like something I would love to explore with you, but we've already taken up enough of your time tonight. So what do you have going on here in 2011 and beyond?
Well, we'll continue to hold down our 6 jobs daily, which keeps us pretty busy. Obviously, continue to look for evidence and cases of spontaneous human combustion. We're looking for understanding as to how this phenomenon occurs, when it occurs, where it occurs, and obviously why it occurs. As we quipped earlier, we'd like to someday receive notification from the Nobel Prize Committee that they've chosen us and our research to warrant a prize in medicine and or in physics. Remains to be seen. We're very optimistic. Other than that, you know, whatever the 14 world drops in our lap, we have an interest in the Thunderbird phenomenon. Probably near and dear to our heart, next only to spontaneous combustion itself at this stage in our life. We're interested in a lot of environmental issues. Here in Pennsylvania, we're dealing with the Marcellus Shale drilling issue right now and its impact on the environment. Back in the 70s, and actually even in the 60s, but mostly in the 70s, we were very active in the nuclear movement. You alluded to our first book, The Parapsychological Impact of the Accident at Three Mile Island. That nuclear power plant and its near meltdown in 1979 is a 15-minute fast drive from our offices. We were very active in that issue back in the 70s, and indeed had written an article that precognized, if you will, the Class 9 accident at Unit 2 at Three Mile Island 8 months before it happened, and then subsequently found many other people in the area who had also been psychically forewarned in various means about that particular accident. That could
Weird.
Be another show for you.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we definitely got to get you back on and talk about that. You must be, then you must have your ears tingling here with all this stuff going on in Japan.
Yeah, the tsunami and its impact on Fukushima was horrifying. But as we said to some folks in the NRC recently, not at the least bit unexpected. We were surprised that they were planning to power a nuclear power plant, in fact, several reactors with batteries. That frankly astonished us, but that's also the case here in the United States, you know. When cooling pumps go down and on-site electricity is lost and off-site power lines are down or blown up or washed away, we are relying on perhaps only 4 hours of battery backup for Indian Point north of New York City. That's a very scary scenario to contemplate, knowing what happened to those folks in Japan.
Absolutely, yeah. It's terrifying. Well, Larry, I can't thank you enough here for coming on the show. As I said, the 2 hours have absolutely flown by, and I've been on the edge of my seat the entire time, and I've just been thrilled with this conversation. As I said at the beginning of the show, I had a feeling it was going to be a classic, and that premonition was definitely borne out here over the last 2 hours. This was an addition to the program that I am thrilled to have produced, so happy to have had you on the program, one that I will put into the archive and highly recommend for people for years to come. This has been an amazing conversation. People should check out your website, parascience.com, and of course, check out his book, Ablaze, The Mysterious Fires of Spontaneous Human Combustion. As we said here at the beginning of the show, this is a centuries-old mystery, and the man we have to thank for it, really, for, as I punningly joked earlier, keeping the torch alive on spontaneous human combustion these last three decades, has been Larry Arnold. Chances are, folks, if you've heard of spontaneous human combustion in the last 30 years, it's as a result of Larry's work. So, Larry, I can't thank you enough, and I can't compliment you and say how much I appreciate your dedication to this mystery over the years and what has, I'm sure, been just a series of detractors and skeptics. And you keep your head down, and you keep collecting the cases, and you keep putting the research out there, and you keep this story alive, which is really so commendable. And I thank you once again for coming on the show.
Well, thank you for your gracious hosting, for your gracious comments, and for respecting this subject as well as our research. It's a difficult one to do. It commands respect, and you have certainly given it to the subject and to us this evening, for which we are most grateful and appreciative. Bless you, and bless everyone who's tuning in tonight and checks out our interview through your archive.
Well, thanks again, Larry.
You're most welcome.
That does it for this installment of BOA Audio Season 6. Big, big thanks to Larry Arnold for coming on the show. Check out his website, www.parascience.com. And, of course, go out and get your hands on his book, Ablaze, The Mysterious Fires of Spontaneous Human Combustion. Let's move on now to BOA Audio listener feedback. We've got three emails in the till, plus a cool story for you at the end. First email comes from Steven, no hometown listed. He says, I'm just some dude from Ohio that works a boring day job. What you do allows me to actually have fun while that's going on. I've only really been interested in a couple of shows regarding the esoteric. The other is the Canadian one with Richard Surrett. I've been meaning to write to say thanks for a while. Steven from Ohio. There you go. Thank you for writing in, Steven. I get really humbled when I get emails from folks who say they listen to the show at their job or when they're working out or, you know, in, I guess you could say, inconvenient places they turn to BOA Audio. And that is really cool to me that I'm helping someone else out there get through a rough work day or a boring work day. So, you know, thanks, Steven. That's really cool. And I hope you're tuning in right now and make sure you file those TPS reports. Next email comes from Andy in the UK. He says, just been reading this, and if you were able to find somebody to speak to about it, I think it would make for an absolutely fascinating show. And then he sends a link to an incident called the Dyatlov Pass accident, which happened in the USSR or Russia in the 1950s. Stunning stuff. Look it up on Google if you want to know more, folks. It's spelled Dyatlov. Pass accident, and it is some weird stuff. A bunch of hikers went off into the woods and never came back again. That's the short version of it. It's quite detailed if you look it up and find the information on it on the internet. He includes a link here, but it's massive, and I just can't read that right now. To get back to Andy's email, he says, I've been a listener for quite a while, but if you've already covered this previously, please let me know so I can go through the archives and hunt it down. Keep up the good work. Cheers, Andy, in the UK. No, I have not covered this topic before, Andy. Very obscure stuff. I think the best guy to talk to about this would be Paul Stonehill, who we had on the program talking about the paranormal and UFOs in the former Soviet Union, but we did not get into this Dyatlov Pass accident. I'll look into it more and see if I can find anything about it that we could explore on the program. My only concern, really, though, is how do you stretch that into a full show? Maybe if we get Paul Stonehill back on the program, we could definitely talk about it then. I'll be sure to put it sort of in the files here next to Paul Stonehill's name, and we'll look into it further as well. Thank you for writing in, Andy. Final email comes from Steph, no hometown listed, and coming to us literally moments before I recorded this segment. She says, when do we get the human spontaneous combustion show? I love you, man, and I'm peeing myself in anticipation for your SponCom show. I've managed to dig up a couple of Larry Arnold interviews elsewhere on the web, but the sound quality is so execrable. Is that even a word? I don't know. Execrable. That even I can't bear to listen to them. It's just made me more desperate, even antsier, waiting as the interminable days drone on, with still no combustion, spontaneous or intentional. Let me tell you, I'm starting to get pretty agitated. Or, I don't know, maybe it's those 42 Diet Cokes I drank before lunch. Just wanted to let you know how much your podcasts mean to some of us out here in internet land, but enough yakking, time to get back to refreshing the Banal homepage. Best wishes, Steph. That was a well-written email from Steph. Thank you for writing in, Steph. It came in right on the wire, and I figured I'd include it here on the show since it came in just as I was about to record the closing comments on the program. Here you go, Steph. Here is your human spontaneous combustion show. Hopefully you have managed not to pee yourself. I think the peeing yourself in anticipation, it loops around here, looking at the email, to your 42 Diet Cokes that you drank before lunch. So I think we found a causal issue here that can exonerate the weight that is BOA Audio. But anyway, hopefully you enjoyed the program and, you know, dug our SponCom showcase. And, of course, thank you for writing in. Now, before I give out the contact info, let me share a cool story with you. I'm going to make it nice and short. A few episodes back, I read an email from a guy named Jim in Michigan. Oh, the Ouija board episode, actually. It was on the Ouija board episode. Anyway, he was in New York for a convention and had the weekend free, shot me an email, wanted to go out for beers, actually drove up to BOA HQ, which is both awesome and kind of scary in a way. I don't know, I shouldn't have given my address to him, but I did because I'm crazy. But it worked out okay, I'm still alive. So, you know, we're one for one on that one. Jim came up, we went out for beers, had a great time, you know. He shared some awesome stories from Michigan, and I was happy to share some behind-the-scenes BOA stories with him, and mostly just get really drunk. And it was a great time, so thanks to Jim for making the trip up here, you know, a weird pilgrimage to see Banal. I can't believe it. I'm stunned that anyone would want to drive that far to meet me and take me out for beers, but I appreciate it. And of course, that means that all you folks out there, the imitations out there, who wants to drive up to BOA HQ and go out for beers? Who will make the next pilgrimage to visit me and get me drunk? This is going to turn out bad, very bad. Here are the ways to contact me if you want to be included in the loop. You can shoot me an email at boaaudio@hotmail.com or go to banalofamerica.com and click the contact button. And, of course, the final method is the interactive zone we like to call BOA's Paranormal Playground. Of course, we're talking about the theusofe.com, theusofe.com. Get on over there, talk about the newest episodes of BOA Audio, pop culture, and the paranormal as well. Plus, if you're into the whole social networking thing, of course, I am on Twitter and Facebook, so punch in Banal on their search engine, you'll find me right away. Befriend me, follow me, or poke me, it's all good, and I'd be happy to have you as part of our circle of friends. Up next, of course, it is time to thank the outstanding and esteemed BOA staff, Leslie, Chiron, Regan Lee, Joe V, Tina Senna, Rochelle Hawks, Richard Thomas, Marla Pena, Bruce Pretty, Tony Morrill, our contributing cartoonist, Andy Carolan, and our webmaster, Jeremy Boston. Up at BOA, since last time you heard from me, Regan Lee digs up an old Gray Barker article and dissects it in Trickster's Realm. Leslie reflects on the summer so far in a column titled Summer Esoterica. the paranormal apostate Bruce Pretty reveals that he is a hardcore Superman fan, and Tony Morrell looks at the problems surrounding the extraterrestrial hypothesis in ETH or Bust, a new column as part of Fortean Ramblings. So four new columns at BOA, tons more in the till as well. Head on over to Banal of America and read the stories from the mind-bending BOA staff. Now comes the time where I ask you to heed a certain call, and that is, of course, the call for donations. We always could use your help here at Banal of America. It is a massive enterprise, and we have designs on growing it more and more as the months and years proceed. So we're going to need your help if we can make that happen. How can you do that? Simple. Go to banalofamerica.com, B-I-N-N-A-L-L of America.com, and click the PayPal button. It's right there on the left-hand side of the screen. I'm looking at it right now. Or if you don't want to use PayPal, you don't trust the internet, and who really does nowadays, then you can donate via snail mail to our P.O. Box. And here is the address for that. Tim Banal, P.O. Box 232, Pinehurst, Mass. 01866. Spell Pinehurst, P-I-N-E-H-U-R-S-T. Hopefully by now you know how it works, but if you don't, please include an email address with your correspondence so I can send you an email back saying thanks. And if you make a donation, please make it payable to Tim Banal and not Banal of America, because my bank is anal. Actually got a really cool letter from someone the other day who's going to be at the Exeter UFO Festival. So let me just plug that as well while we're here in sort of the plug area of the program. We're coming up on it real quick. It is Saturday, September 3rd in Exeter, New Hampshire, talking about the third annual Exeter UFO Festival. I'll be serving as MC. Speakers include Stanton Friedman, Richard Dolan, Kathleen Martin, as well as a film on the Betty and Barney Hill abduction case. And best of all, folks, it is absolutely 100% free. That's right, no cost. Find a way to get to Exeter and you can check out the proceedings. Just walk right through the door at the town hall in Exeter, New Hampshire. This is an amazing event. I love it every year. I'm humbled and honored to be the host once again for the big event. It is a blast. Last year we had a ton of people there. Word of mouth, I think, is going to drive this thing even bigger this year. I've heard from tons of folks, as I said just now, just wrote me a letter, some guy, saying he was going to be at the Exeter UFO Festival with his buddies. Couldn't wait to meet up. So hopefully the BOA audio listeners are there and representing BOA Nation. If you are, find me, shake my hand, please, I hope. And, you know, you don't obligated to buy me a beer, but if you see me out in the town, come on over, stop by, say hello. Let me know you're a listener of the program. It would be awesome to hear from all the folks out there. The website for the big event is www.exeterufofestival.com, E-X-E-T-E-R-U-F-O-Festival.com. Check it out, folks. The third annual Exeter UFO Festival. Be there or be square. Next time on the program, our guests are going to be longtime BOA Audio friends, Marie Jones and Larry Flaxman. Every year we sit down with these two kooky folks and have just a wild conversation. This year is no different. We are going to be talking about the Trinity Secret at the beginning of the show, but it just devolves into a jam session and really just a grouse session on the state of ghost hunting and the ghost research field. So if you like that kind of stuff, if you like us bitching about ghost hunters, you're going to love this conversation. It was a lot of fun. Marie Jones, Larry Flaxman, always a fun time when they show up on the program. We get tons of emails from folks who love those annual installments. Well, you're in luck because we've got one coming at you next time on BOA Audio. And on that note, let's close the book on this installment of the program. Once again, thanks to Larry Arnold for coming on the show, giving us so much time and really teaching us so much about the weirdness that is spontaneous human combustion. Thanks to Stephen, Andy, and Steph for their contributions to BOA Audio Listener Feedback. And, of course, big, big thanks to all you folks out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners, the people who do not press stop until the program ends. You guys are awesome. Thank you for listening to me all this time. I know it's been a rough go of it so far here in Season 6, but come on. How about that spontaneous human combustion episode? Listen, folks,
I know sometimes you're going to have to wait 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks for an episode of the program, but when BOA Audio delivers, we deliver the goods, and I stand by that. Hopefully, a conversation like what you've just heard has proven in a way to all you guys out there that this program just keeps chugging along, and we've got some amazing plans for the future. And that is, of course, thanks to all you people out there, the hardcore BOA Audio listeners and the BOA Audio listening audience in general. You guys are the fuel that drives the machine. I cannot thank you enough for your support of the program. Obviously, thank you for making BOA Audio a part of your esoteric audio playlist. And until next time, this is Tim Banal, signing off.